From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Jeff Sessions goes before the Senate Intelligence Committee this afternoon to testify about his role in the firing of FBI Director James Comey, despite his recusal from the FBI's Russia investigation. This morning, the man now overseeing that investigation, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, testified. He said he sees no reason to fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel who's now in charge of investigating possible Trump campaign ties to Russia and Russian election hacking. Here's Rosenstein being questioned by Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire.
Now, as I understand, Mr. Rosenstein, in this matter, you are actually the one exercising hiring and firing authority because Attorney General Sessions is recused. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And at this point, have you seen any evidence of good cause for firing of Special Counsel Mueller?
No, I have not.
Let's bring in NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And the reason we're talking about the possible firing of Robert Mueller is because a friend of President Trump, media executive Chris Ruddy, went on the PBS NewsHour last night and said the president is thinking about doing that. Here he is.
I think he's considering perhaps terminating the special counsel. I think he's weighing that option. I think it's pretty clear by what one of his lawyers said on television recently. I personally think it would be a very significant mistake.
Now, the White House is pushing back on that, but is it possible that Robert Mueller would be fired by President Trump?
Well, there's a lot that has to go in there. This is pretty complicated, so I'll try to unpack it just a little bit. But Ruddy, runs the right-wing news site Newsmax.
Right.
And he's friends with Donald Trump. He often talks with Donald Trump and somebody that Trump confides in. So it's believable enough that Ruddy might get some information from the president or people close to the president that say maybe he's considering it. Remember, Donald Trump fired James Comey as FBI director and then bragged to Russian diplomats that, hey, now pressure has been taken off. But the White House, as you noted, pushed back and said that he never talked to President Trump. And Ruddy then pushed back in his own statement and said, I never said I ever talked to President Trump about it, but I have very good sources within the White House who are saying that it's something that's being considered. Now, on both sides of the aisle, in many places, this is being condemned as a potential possibility. You had Adam Schiff, who's the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, say that it would be a big mistake. He said, don't waste our time, because if Mueller was fired, then they would establish an independent counsel and appoint Bob Mueller. So that would be a problem. Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said the move would be a disaster. Susan Collins of Maine said that it would be, quote, extraordinarily unwise. Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, said that they need to be independent, these investigations. So you have a lot of that going on. And you have Kevin McCarthy, who's the House Majority Leader, saying that he's accusing the media of creating a rumor that's not happening. Now, the media is not creating a rumor that isn't happening. This is, harkens back to the idea that you have the potential for firing the special counsel here. And this is all about Donald Trump and the White House trying to create something of their own, or supporters at least of Donald Trump trying to create at least something to stir up.
Well, and I'm sure that Attorney General Jeff Sessions is going to be asked about this today. But other than that, what are you expecting from this Sessions testimony?
Well, look, Jeff Sessions has a lot to answer for, especially considering what James Comey said in his testimony last week. Remember, James Comey said that there were some questions about Jeff Sessions, about a potential there were potential questions about a third meeting with the Russian ambassador.
Because we already know about two meetings.
We know about two of those meetings. So we want to know what are the actual contacts, and what did the Russians expect from Sessions? Who did they think they were talking to? And we also want to know, when James Comey says that he told the attorney general, don't leave me in a room again with Donald Trump by myself, well, what was Sessions' response to that? Did Comey talk to him about this? The thing I love about this, and I said this before on your show, is that everybody here is now going to have to be under oath. And if somebody found to be lying about something, that bar is much higher and they could go to jail for that.
Well, what's at stake for Sessions right now?
His job, let's be honest. I mean, Donald Trump is not thrilled with the fact that Jeff Sessions recused himself in the Russia investigation, and Donald Trump feels like him recusing himself just gave more fuel to the potential investigation into his campaign and his associates' ties to Russia.
So Donald Trump will be watching this hearing today, I'm sure, and
very
you're saying
closely.
If he doesn't like what he hears from Jeff Sessions, that could be problematic for the attorney general.
Right. Absolutely. And when you think about, you know, what they've tried to do with this Chris Ruddy situation where they go out and talk about, you know, some of this stuff, it's a lot about what this White House tries to do to manufacture news cycles, create conflicts and distract from other pressing issues.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Domenico, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it's been less than a year since General Electric announced the move of its headquarters after 40 years from Connecticut to Boston. Now Aetna, the insurance company founded in Hartford more than 150 years ago, says it's exploring new possibilities for its headquarters. Harriet Jones of Here and Now contributor WNPR reports on the turbulence corporate flight is leaving in its wake.
This is Farmington Avenue in Hartford, on the doorstep of one of Aetna's massive buildings. The company has more than 1.5 million square feet of office space in the city, and so many workers come and go from the surrounding suburbs that the state of Connecticut built a new busway to bring them to work. But now the city is facing the prospect that Aetna will no longer fly its corporate flag in Hartford.
Well, it's not helpful. I don't think any of us can say that we're surprised, but that doesn't mean that we haven't fought for every job.
That's Connecticut's Governor Daniel Malloy in a press conference on the day Aetna confirmed it was considering its options. The state is clinging on to one crumb of comfort. While Aetna's headquarters, along with the corporate officers, may relocate, the company says it will keep the bulk of its 5,800 Hartford workers in place. Joe Arasimowitz is Speaker of the House of Representatives in Connecticut.
Aetna's not going to take the gold dome off the top of the building, rip the sign down, and then head out of town. They're still going to have a very large presence.
But he concedes the loss of such a storied headquarters is still a blow, and one for which state legislators must bear some of the blame.
Our inactivity, our unwillingness to come up with an overall goal for our urban centers in the state of Connecticut is yet again costing us dearly. It costs us repeatedly with the achievement gap. It costs us dearly now in economic development.
So, is the state of Connecticut's cities really at the heart of the problem? Aetna declined to comment for this story, but made a brief statement that it's looking for a different kind of environment. Its goal is, quote, broadening our access to innovation and the talent that will fill knowledge economy-type positions. Hartford's Mayor Luke Bronin.
I think one of the things that's so powerful about Aetna's decision is that it reinforces a point that I've been trying to make to the suburbs and to the state as a whole, which is that we are all tied together, that our economic future depends on building a new kind of partnership between the state of Connecticut and our cities.
The cities aren't able to tap into an ample tax base like their wealthier suburbs. Right now, Bronin is trying to wrangle a fiscal crisis in Hartford so deep it might lead to bankruptcy. He's looking for a bailout from the state, but that ask is made more difficult by Connecticut's own budget gap, now estimated at more than $5 billion over the next 2 years. Earlier this year, Aetna, along with its fellow insurers, the Hartford and Travelers, themselves promised their home city an infusion of $50 million over 5 years to try to stabilize its situation. Bronin says when a major corporate partner threatens to leave, urban renewal should become everyone's problem.
The immediate impact on the city's finances, I don't think, will be significant. What is significant is that it sends a message. You can't be a strong suburb of a struggling city. And that if we want to be competitive as a state, we need to recognize that companies aren't looking for suburban office parks. They're looking for vibrant metropolitan areas.
We are re-urbanizing as a region of the country.
That's Bob Santee, who heads up the nonprofit Connecticut Economic Resource Center. He says for the first time since the 1920s, the growth in population in Connecticut is currently happening in its cities, despite their problems. But it's being far outpaced by even bigger nearby centers, notably Manhattan and Boston. So, suburban sprawl is out, and citing your employees in an exciting entrepreneurial urban environment is in. But Sandy says what's curious about Aetna's announcement is that it actually plans to leave most of its younger workers in Hartford when the headquarters relocates.
I think it's ironic that the people that would probably move are not the ones they're messaging here. I mean, they supposedly are talking to millennials, and I think in both the GE instance and this instance, they're going to be moving senior executives who are not the millennials. So I really do think it's about image.
Aetna hasn't said where it's planning to relocate. GE, of course, decamped to Boston's fashionable Seaport District. The smart money is on Aetna choosing Manhattan, known to be a favorite spot of CEO Mark Bertolini. Here was Governor Malloy's take.
There is no book about corporate relocation that doesn't make the following point, that where the chief executive wants to be is the most important factor.
So, while Connecticut continues to struggle with its public finances, its business climate, and its urban policy, it seems to have been beaten to the punch by two nearby cities, not low-tax havens, but prestigious and increasingly dynamic commercial centres that have engineered their own revivals. For Here and Now, I'm Harriet Jones in Hartford.
Houston-based Cheniere Energy made its first shipment of natural gas to Eastern Europe last week to Poland, which bought the gas to help reduce its dependence on Russia. Cheniere operates the only export terminal in the lower 48 that has permission to ship liquefied natural gas, or LNG, to foreign countries. But that's about to change. Gary Cohn, director of the Trump administration's National Economic Council, said this back in April.
We could be and should be the largest exporter of LNG in the world. We have the molecules. We just have not permitted the exporting. We're going to permit the exporting.
According to the federal government, about half a dozen export terminals are under construction now. Many more are planned. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd has this report from the Gulf Coast of Louisiana.
The terminals are big, billion-dollar operations that chill the gas into a liquid so it can be loaded onto a ship and sold around the globe. And officials in Port Fourchon in southern Louisiana want in on the action.
So we're in the commercial fishing marina right now. So this is where the larger scale shrimpers are, and then the recreational guys, and those guys kayaking. Hey!
A port manager named Joni Tuck is on board a port police boat. It's navigating a channel between much larger ships that bring supplies to oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. We pass a cement plant.
Big pile of rocks. Big piles of different kinds of rocks. They're very pedantic about the size of rocks.
And then we find ourselves face to face with one reason people here are bullish on natural gas. Chet Chasson is the port's executive director.
And we're right in the middle of the channel looking at the Harvey Energy, which is an LNG-fueled vessel.
In a nutshell, because people listening to this can't see it.
Sure.
It is big. It is blue. And it is just sort of like a hulking piece of equipment.
Absolutely. It's exactly what you said. It's big, blue, and bad.
And very rare.
This is one of only four currently in the United States vessels operating on LNG as a fuel.
But Chasson says that number is growing. A mandate from the UN's International Maritime Organization requires ocean vessels to cut back on toxic sulfur emissions by 2020. As a result, companies like Energy World USA see an opportunity to fill those massive tanks with natural gas. Kevin Blount is the company's president.
We see that there's going to be more and more marine vessels being encouraged, are being encouraged now, to convert, to switch their fleets to LNG, or to actually purchase new builds that are going to run on cleaner, greener, liquefied natural gas, as opposed to heavy fuel oils and diesels that the traditional marine vessels have run on.
Your idea is to make a much larger scale gas station, essentially,
yes.
Right here on the other side of this port.
Yes, and our plans are actually to build a large facility that will offer LNG both for export and for domestic use.
Blount says the fueling station is just part of the idea. It's shipping the LNG around the world that's at the heart of his proposal. When the company submits that plan to the federal government within 30 days, it will officially be part of the rush to capitalize on the country's vast supply of natural gas.
So I wouldn't refer to it as a glut.
Eric Smith is the associate director of Tulane University's Energy Institute.
But what I would say is that we needed additional markets, and the most logical market was to go into the world market where gas trades typically at a higher price than it does domestically.
Smith says many of those proposed export hubs will be refurbished terminals that were once used to import natural gas. But critics like the Sierra Club say the coming export boom will encourage more fracking, which will do more damage to the environment. They say new pipelines will wipe out fragile wetlands, and the energy it takes to cool the gas will make LNG exports as dirty as coal. Critics also worry that shrinking the domestic supply of gas will make it more expensive at home.
No, I'm not worried that these facilities are going to take gas away from the United States.
Corey Grindle is a senior VP at Cheniere Energy, the company that runs the only export terminal in the lower 48.
We have enough of it, and we have enough of it for a very long time, even with the growing demand.
Cheniere opened its plant early last year on the border of Texas and Louisiana. Grindle says there's room for more competition, but some of the pending 24 projects will fail.
I don't think that all of them will be built. I think that the limit of what can be built will really be decided by customer contracts. I don't think that you'll see any of these built on a speculative basis.
Energy World USA President Kevin Blount says he's confident his project will get built. On the boat in Port Fourchon, we can see the empty land where the refrigeration units might go.
Look how close we are to the Gulf. That's a big, big plus.
It would also be a plus to the local economy, say port officials Joni Tuck and Chet Chesson.
Because everything else that happens in Port Fourchon outside of the recreational commercial fishing aspect, everything, for the most part, is related to the price of a barrel of oil.
So all business, those rigs in the Gulf
exactly,
right there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The price of a barrel of oil matters to our business. Well, the price of a barrel of oil does not matter to the export of LNG across the world.
With oil prices stuck in the $40 range, Tuck says the area has lost 14,000 jobs in the past 2 years.
When you drive down the bayou, you see for sale signs for everything. Every camper and motorbike and quad bike and recreational property is on the block.
So do you think people see LNG in a project like this as a bit of a lifeline?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Chet nailed it on the head. It's a diversification, and that's a word that people in our community have been saying a lot more since the drop in the price of oil.
If the project gets the green light, Port Fourchon could be shipping gas around the globe within 4 years. By then, it's anyone's guess if the natural gas market will look as good as it does today. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And he is the real MVP. Kevin Durant of the Golden State Warriors once famously said that about his mom at a teary press conference. She was the real MVP. But last night, he was most valuable player, powering his Golden State Warriors to the NBA championship, the second in 3 years for the Oakland team. The Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavs 129-120. Yes, the Cavs had one of the most awesome halves in NBA history in Game 4 to come back from a 3-0 deficit, but the Warriors win it. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the podcast, The Gist, at SlateJock.com. Thoughts?
Well, going into the season, there was the thought of the Warriors being the super team, and they showed it, even though they didn't equal the regular season record of the prior year. By adding Durant, they just became a much better team. And if you count the number of losses, including playoff losses, they had fewer losses this year than last year. And oh yeah, they won a championship. This was, you know, the greatest collection of talent, but also the greatest collection of talent playing together. They are a juggernaut.
Well, Kevin Durant, take that up. After 8 seasons with the Oklahoma City Thunder, he joins the Warriors. Very criticized at that time. Some fans thought, stay and build a team instead of joining a dynasty. But you're saying what? It was a piece that juggernaut needed?
Well, you know, I don't know if they needed it, but I think Durant needed it. He was, I'm not going to say stuck there in Oklahoma City. They did take that Warrior team to 7 games last year. But the thing about free agents is that they have agency, and maybe the sports fans want to lock players in to contracts or reenact the old clauses, which just never let them leave their teams. But this is 2017, and in fact, I think what the Warriors were giving us were a glimpse of the future. So now other teams, terms of roster construction, and LeBron James was talking about this. They're scratching their heads, wondering what they can do. But I think maybe there's some maneuvering that they can do to assemble other parts. But the other lesson I would take is that how the Warriors play should be something that other teams pay attention to. It's not just that they play as the greatest individuals, they play as the greatest team. And that's going to be hard to replicate, but easier to replicate than assembling the second, third, fifth, or eighth best players in the league, or however you want to rank them.
Talk more about what LeBron James was saying.
In a post-game press conference, and LeBron was amazing. He averaged a triple-double. He really had almost a flawless series. He essentially got exhausted at the end of Game 3 and allowed Durant to get some key buckets down the half. But LeBron said, I'm not ashamed. I absolutely did the best I could do, and it wasn't good enough. And he's wondering if it'll ever be good enough. Now, you could take that as despair, or you could take that as a shot across the bow to management, essentially saying, we've got to get better. We have a good team. Some called us, as the Cavaliers, a great team or a super team. Ain't super enough.
Now, by the way, what do you think? Is this the last year for this matchup?
LeBron's in the finals every year. No, I think that these two teams were a class ahead, and unless there's some massive free agent changes, I would expect them to be in the finals next year. I don't see how the Warriors could lose for 2 or 3 years. I fully expect them to win, say, 3 of the next 4 championships.
Oh, boy. Is that boring for the sport?
It might be. I don't know. Talk to me in 3 or 4 years' time. Okay. It might be, but okay. I might be wrong.
Couple last observations. Steph Curry's daughters are just the most adorable children in the world. They show up there at the end. But what about these reports, Mike Pesca, that the Warriors may not go to the White House to see the president?
Richard Jefferson of the Cavaliers this year and last predicted last year his team would be the last NBA team to go to visit the White House, meaning Jefferson, who was very involved in politics, was saying that he couldn't see any NBA team visiting a Trump White House. That may well be the case.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, giving us the gist on the NBA championship. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first 3 meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The Federal Reserve kicked off a 2-day meeting today. Tomorrow, the Fed is expected to announce yet another interest rate increase. It would be the 4th rate hike in 2 years. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we've seen the Fed inching up its key interest rate. What's believed to be behind the likely hike tomorrow?
Well, the main thing is that they already forecast it. And now, a sign of how sure we are, Fed Funds Futures, which is a popular tool for betting on the Fed's policy outlook, shows a 99.6 chance that Fed raises its rates at this week's meeting. And as you said, it came after doing so last December, and in March, it lift the benchmark rate to between 1% and 1.25%, which is still a very low level historically. The reason for doing it is that unemployment numbers are really low right now. And so that's the Fed's main goal, and they want to prevent inflation.
How much more of this are we likely to see this year? More rate hikes?
Depends largely on politics. Since raising rates in March, many officials have said they would probably want to lift the rates twice, the one potentially tomorrow, most likely tomorrow, and then again in September. But the Fed could defer the September move if Congress decides to delay action on raising the federal government's debt ceiling. And that could cause all kinds of disarray. And so that's one thing that could block that move.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting this week on a meeting between President Trump and the Fed chair, Janet Yellen. What happened there?
Well, it was roughly a 15-minute conversation, according to people familiar with the exchange. And he told her she was doing a good job. Have you heard that before?
Well, and this is somebody who has really criticized her before he took office. He said, she does whatever Obama wants her to do.
That's right. Yeah, Trump accused Yellen of keeping rates low to help Democrats. But you know, what Mr. Trump wants is a fast-growing economy, and that means he doesn't want the Fed to be raising interest rates so aggressively that it thwarts any potential boom.
Jason, while we have you, some breaking business tech news this afternoon. The CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, is going to take a leave of absence from the company, according to an internal email. This is something that's been talked about for a long time. What more do we know about it at this point?
What we know is that there's no specific return date for him, and this comes after a months-long investigation into the workplace culture at Uber. The board on Sunday pushed for his removal. This is after an investigative report by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. He presented this report that we may see a summary of very soon.
It actually is just coming out, and one of the things in there is the letter from Travis to the staff, and he says the ultimate responsibility for where we've gotten and how we've gotten here rests on my shoulders. There is, of course, much to be proud of, but there is much to improve. So we will see what happens at Uber after the news that Travis Kalanick, the CEO, is going to take a leave of absence from the company. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Today, inquests were opened into the deaths of five of the eight victims killed in this month's attack on the London Bridge and Borough Market. Investigators continuing to find out what's known about the three attackers, a British citizen born in Pakistan, a Moroccan Libyan, and a Moroccan Italian. The car and knife attack shattered a Saturday night. It was one of several in the past few months claimed by ISIS. And it's added to the ongoing question. In the puzzle that is terrorism, what are the puzzle parts? Yes, extremist ideology. Yes, a region destabilized by recent wars. But how much is this unrest tied to Europe's colonial history? Michael Provance is a professor of Middle East history at the University of California, San Diego. He's also got a new book out, The Last Ottoman Generation and the Making of the Modern Middle East. He joins us now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, our call to you was prompted by a question from a young person as we were watching coverage of the Saturday night attack. And he said, why are there so many people from other countries in England? Could you remind us, how did that happen?
Well, of course, Britain and France dominated a lot of the world as colonial empires from the 19th century into about the middle of the last century, the 20th century. So all of North Africa, much of Central Africa were French colonies, and much of the Middle East, Syria, Lebanon, French colonies, British colonies in Palestine, today's Israel, Jordan, Iraq, informal colony in Iran, of course, all of South Asia, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Burma.
Well, can you make a tie? Can you make a direct tie between that colonial imperialist history and what's happening today?
Well, maybe not a direct tie, but there's certain things that I think are important. Colonial governments don't colonize countries based on consent. And in a situation of continual crisis of legitimacy, colonial governments dominate their populations by violence and recourse to different types of corruption. And so these kinds of habits, I think, have a long afterlife. And we see that in the Middle East today and in other regions as well. There's a habit of corruption and of dealing with internal dissent in a violent way. So that's the main legacy, I would say, of the colonial governments.
Well, and others are very happy to draw a really straight line. Here's a headline from The Guardian. Immigration will remain a toxic issue until Britain faces up to its colonial past. Here's one from Salon. The secret history of terror in Europe, how our blindness to a century of mistakes is making everyone less safe. And it goes on to say, Great Britain and France transform what had been relatively quiet province of the Ottoman Empire into one of the least stable and internationally explosive states in the world. It's not just about what happened in the colonial eras, but it's about how parts of the world were carved up.
Well, the real carve-up of the Middle East, of course, was after the First World War, when all of the countries of the region were written out on the map in secret negotiations between Britain and France, and then adjudicated immediately after the First World War, a little less than 100 years ago from today. So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the conflict between Kurdistan and the surrounding states, the Lebanese civil war, and in a way, the Syrian civil war today, all of these things have their roots directly in that period and those kinds of decisions that were made by British and French policymakers at that time. So when people are fleeing the continual conflicts, they're fleeing the colonial legacy itself.
Well, and you're talking about the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916.
That's right.
It gave what was then Mesopotamia, Iraq, the Gulf area, and the regions that were bordering then Palestine to Great Britain. Syria and most of the eastern part of the region was given to France. Stephen Kinzer, the former New York Times correspondent, is one of those who says it's no coincidence that France and Britain, two of the countries most affected by recent terror attacks, have this history as two of the most outstanding empires. But remind us further why peoples who were under the empire, why would they end up in France and Britain?
They fled war and conflict that was brought by the colonial government in India with partition, with the Algerian civil war, with the Lebanese civil war, with civil wars that are taking place now. And they came for economic reasons and in search of a better life, like anyone else. But the generations who have grown up in these countries are often not treated very well and don't enjoy full citizenship rights or access to the kinds of things that the full citizens of these countries enjoy. So there's a sort of a differential model of citizenship in some cases.
Well, and we have to add, too, for France, you have the defeat in the Algerian War of Independence. I mean, Algeria threw off the yoke of colonialism.
That's right. And in a situation of appalling violence where the French government killed hundreds of thousands of people in order to hang on to Algeria over the course of a couple of years and then abandon the country anyway. So these kinds of things and the colonial counterinsurgencies that Britain and France waged, people haven't dealt with them. They haven't discussed them. They haven't It's not part of the public discourse on a very serious level in these countries. So the wounds that continue to fester over the colonial history are undealt with or undiscussed.
And what should have happened? Because the other thing that we're seeing as police race into these neighborhoods where it's suspected some of these attackers have come from, these are insulated neighborhoods. They are usually made up of just the immigrant population. Should there have been an attempt to integrate them more fully into the mainstream population? Did the people who came not want to be mainstream?
Well,
what happened there?
I mean, colonialism, and we can draw on the recent history of the United States and Iraq, can only really happen in a situation where people in the colonizing country, in the militarily dominant country, imagine that the people of other countries don't have the same rights or even the same consciousness or same race that they have. So there's an idea that they are entitled to dominate other people, and this is kind of the first step for a colonizing country. Once those people come and try to gain full citizenship in the countries that used to colonize them, that racial rift, that cleavage, doesn't just go away. Mm-hmm. So those people are disenfranchised and not offered the same kind of employment or the same kind of educational facilities or the same housing or the same rights to participate and to represent themselves in the countries where they find themselves.
We're reading others say that in order to colonize somebody, in order to suppress a population, you have to think of them as less than. That's why you need to rule over them. And so you're saying that that doesn't go away even over generations.
That's right. I mean, if we remember the kind of things that American politicians said about Iraq before the invasion, they're failing at modernity, and we have to go and bring Iraq into the modern world. So this kind of arrogance doesn't square well with integrating people and assimilating people who are different.
But is there something that could have been done? For instance, now we're seeing the newly elected French president, Emmanuel Macron, describe French rule in Algeria as barbaric, a crime against humanity. He was roundly criticized by the right for that. But is that something that people in North Africa need to hear?
Well, the people in North Africa have their own problems. But France and Britain have not been immigrant societies in a simple way. The United States is different. And so the story of people coming here and becoming Americans without most people questioning their Americanness is quite different than the experience in Europe, where people who come from North Africa, even after many generations, or from Turkey, or from the Arab states, will be asked again and again and again, what are you really? Even if you speak French perfectly, even if you have a Manchester accent, people will not accept that you are truly English or truly French. And until that changes, there will be angry, disaffected, disenfranchised people who act out in ways that are traumatic for everyone.
Do you think maybe the U.S. is changing now as well?
I hope not. Mm. If we change in that way, it won't be a good thing.
That's Michael Provance, professor of Middle East history at the University of California, San Diego. Again, taking a look at just one puzzle part in the story of terrorism. Professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
NBC's Megyn Kelly is defending her upcoming interview with conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones. The interview hasn't aired yet. It'll be on NBC this weekend on Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly. But already, a clip promoting the interview is causing major controversy. In it, Kelly asks Jones about both 9/11, which he calls an inside job, and the mass shooting of children at Sandy Hook.
Well, Sandy Hook's complex because I've had debates where we've devil's advocate said the whole story's true, and then I've had debates where I've said that none of it's true.
When you say parents faked their children's death, people get very angry.
Yeah, well, I know, but they don't get angry about the 500,000 dead Iraqis from the sanctions, or they don't get angry about all the
illegals
pouring
in. That's a dodge.
No, it's not a dodge. The media never covers all the evil wars it's promoted, all the
big
things.
That doesn't excuse what you did and said about Newtown. You know it.
Here's the difference. I looked at all the angles of Newtown, and I made my statements long before the media even picked up on it.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now for more on this. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Nelba Marquez Green, whose 6-year-old daughter, Anna Grace, was killed at Sandy Hook, was one of the first to express outrage over Kelly having Jones on her show. She tweeted, "To give a man like this such a platform normalizes behavior that isn't normal." She's also been highlighting a lot of the harassment she gets online from people who believe Jones's theories that Sandy Hook never happened. She says, quote, "Every week, 5 years later, still harassed by truthers. You do not give a crazy a platform. You're better than this, NBC." What do you think about this, about NBC deciding to run this interview with Alex Jones?
I think it's very easy to make a coherent and plausible argument for why he should not be given that platform. I mean, we just heard in that brief excerpt a whole incredible basket of garbled thinking and, essentially justification for horrific activities. I mean, he's a conspiracy theorist. He claimed that Sandy Hook was staged. The kids were actors. He's propagated conspiracy theories about 9/11 and about Pizzagate, which, may have influenced. We don't know exactly, but may have influenced the guy who went to a pizza parlor in Washington and shot it up. At the same time, I actually, as a journalist, don't think any person is inherently off limits. I think we could argue that there could be a very good interview done with the leader of North Korea, who is seen as one of the worst threats to the well-being of the United States. The real question is what you do with the interview, what kind of tone is set, what kind of questions are asked, what's elicited, and also whether or not you surround it with vigorous reporting and contextualize it. I think doing something that's the equivalent of a live interview with somebody who doesn't turn the knob just up to 11 but 11,000 and essentially forms as a human steamroller is really fraught. And I think that Kelly and NBC have set themselves a very high hurdle to surmount. But I don't think inherently it's you can't interview somebody who is nonetheless despicable.
Yeah, the question was asked today, should Charlie Rose not have interviewed Bashar al-Assad, the leader of Syria, if we're going to go by this standard? And you should also point out that Alex Jones has the ear of President Trump to some degree. He's been on Alex Jones's show in the past. InfoWars got temporary White House press credentials.
Yeah, I think, look, the difference between cable news and network news is network news should actually be newsworthy. And I think Alex Jones has risen to that level in two ways, one of which he's caught the eye of President Trump, who before entering the White House certainly appeared on Alex Jones's show and praised him rather lavishly during that appearance. Additionally, I think that Alex Jones has propagated some of what can be charitably called BS that circulates through the through alt-right conspiracy theories and memes. You know, he's not, as Kelly described him in one of the promotions for the interview, a conservative talk host. He's really kind of a right-wing conspiracy theorist. A theory propagating libertarian, and he really has fit in neatly with the growth of this alt-right movement and alt-right media online that propagates things that are deeply harmful to our understanding of how politics actually works.
David, Megyn Kelly's show is very new. The fact that we're talking about Alex Jones and not about her show is interesting just by itself, because her ratings were not great in the first time that she put her show on the air. And I'm thinking also Greta Van Susteren, another former Fox News anchor who's now on MSNBC. Her ratings have not been good either. Do Fox News hosts just not translate outside of Fox News?
It's not clear. You know, Greta Van Susteren, to deal with her quickly, wasn't really one of the most ideological or figures at Fox News. She was, you know, more conservative sounding than she was perhaps on CNN, but really not anything like, right, you know, the Sean Hannity of the world. Megyn Kelly has, you know, shed or abandoned some, you know, tonally in her brief few appearances on NBC, you know, some of the you could call them obsessions, certainly interests she had that you know, played into the Roger Ailes style programming that we came to expect over the years at Fox, that really harped on certain kinds of conservative bogeymen.
Right.
But she's finding ways to stir controversy even in these first few episodes. Her ratings did fine that first episode for their expectations. I think they declined second time around. And I think the question is, you know, whether she can prove up to the challenge,
right,
of making this a worthwhile interview as opposed to merely a controversy.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And here and now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.